They moved in next door to us. They weren't there that long. I got quite friendly with John, the man that lived in the house. I remember one day I went into the house and the checkbook was just up on the worktop, and it was just purely opportunistic. I wrote it for £30. I brought it in. I cashed it. I didn't want to do it. I didn't like doing it, but I did it. Why will a drug addict rob a handbag on the street? Or why will an alcoholic rob money at work? You don't think, when you're in the position where you're addicted to something and you need. And for me, a bet was the fix. I needed a fix. I needed to get, you know, people have come to me and said, geez, you must have got a great laugh out of that, the way you pulled the wool over that fella's eyes or did this, that and the other thing. And I'm just kind of thinking, no, I didn't. No, I don't. There was times where I was thinking of ways of scamming money or pulling strokes or whatever, but I'd be actually nearly physically sick because I knew what I was about to do. I knew I was going to do it, even though I was telling myself it was the wrong thing to do. You physically and mentally torture yourself. It's not a nice way to live at all.
In the time between you taking the check and you getting caught for that, I mean, what's going through your head?
You would have started out thinking, oh, yeah, I'm definitely going to pay him back. Then after a week or two, you're beginning to worry. And then you're thinking, right, did I get away with it? Because, you know, there's nobody saying anything to me about this. But then obviously when they do twig, it's gone and the bank statements arrive at home, then the shit's going to hit the fan. And it did. And they sent the guards out. That was the first time the guards ever knocked on the door. I was at a point where I didn't really care about myself or the reaction or the consequences of it for me. But I knew that anytime the guards ever pulled up outside the house, I could literally see the blood drain from my mother. But it never seemed to stop me, unfortunately.
From Wine Tavern Productions, in association with Go Loud, this is The Gambler. Episode 3, Catch Me If You Can.
I think the same year, or certainly within the same time frame, you again steal from a friend.
Yeah, that was the guy that I used to drink with in the Brazenhead around the time I had the big bet. We went to a concert in The Point, New Year's Eve that year, and we had a great night and we were drinking and having the crack or whatever, and we stayed in the B&B, I remember, in Gardiner Street, and he was really drunk and he was unconscious in the bed, and I got up and I knew we were going back to Limerick, and I knew the next day was New Year's Day, and New Year's Day was always a good day for gambling, for racing or whatever the case may be. And I remember I'd spent whatever I'd spent, I had very little money left, and I remember I knew his PIN number from his ATM card. He actually told me his PIN number ages before that. And I just purely opportunistically said, fuck it, do you know what? I'll be able to give it back to him. But again, same story. Did it without consequence, or without fear of consequence, and lost it. Wasn't able to repay him. And I suppose part of me was hoping that I'd win an amount of money that I'd be able to go to him and say, look, sorry, this happened. Or even lodge it into his bank account or something without him knowing. There's always an answer in my mind, or a solution in my mind, that makes no sense. But it makes sense to me at that time. There's no real explaining it. It's just, you know, it's just purely addiction-driven madness. Madness. Because that guy that I stole that money from that we're talking about, he's a reasonable fella. I probably would have been able to sit down with him and say, look, I've gone through a bad time. I did this. I'm really sorry. Right? He might never have spoken to me again, but I'm pretty sure he probably would let me just repay him and jog on. And if push comes to shove, I could have went home to my parents and said, look, I'm after fucking up. And they would have given me money like that to do it. But for some reason, no. Either I thought I was too clever or too stupid or too something. But I always had this thing about telling nobody what was going on with me and trying to solve everything by myself. If there was a problem, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to get it fixed. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to fix it myself. Only I thought I knew how to fix things that I didn't know how to fix. That one hurt for a simple reason that I had developed a persona in that pub where I was extremely popular with everyone that I wanted to be extremely popular with. The minute I did that and he told everyone, I became a pariah, and that fucking killed me. I remember after that happened, I turned into a recluse almost for a long time after that. I just felt that was the end of the world for me there then, at that time, you know.
Pat's early crimes might have been small, at least in terms of the money involved, but they had an immediate impact on his life. The guards came to his house and he was charged with forgery in the first instance and then with theft. This led to his first appearances before a judge in Limerick District Court.
I'm Alan English, editor of the Sunday Independent and former editor of the Limerick Leader. The first time I came across Pat Sheedy was, I think, 1989. I was a young reporter at the Limerick Leader, and I'd been down in court covering the district court, which was a very eventful place. I used to sit beside the acclaimed writer Kevin Barry, who later said that all of life passed through the Limerick courts, you know. I don't actually remember his case coming up. My memory is that a few hours later, I got a call from the receptionists in the Limerick Leader office. I was back in the office writing up my copy, and somebody down in the front office to see me. So I went down, and I have very, very vivid memory of this little episode now, you know. He was sort of sitting in the corner of the office, kind of trying to sort of be discreet, called over, and he said he had been up in court, and he'd been given the Probation Act, and that you know, he was very anxious as to whether something was going to appear in the paper. And I said, well, you know, you've been given the Probation Act, but that doesn't mean, you know, the paper is still allowed to report on that, you know. And it was a pretty petty stuff, really. So he made this big pitch. He was very, very persuasive, saying that, you know, this was going to ruin his life, that the court had given him a chance, and would the Limerick Leader not give him a chance, you know, that, you know, if it came out that he had been in court for something, he wouldn't get a job. He was probably maybe 20 at this stage. So I said, look, that's above my pay grade, Pat. I'll have to have a word with the editor about this, you know. So I remember going up the stairs to the editor, Brendan Halligan, said to him, look, this is the situation. He said, well, what do you make of him? You know, is he a decent fella? I said, yeah, he comes across as, you know, very contrite, very genuine. You know, I couldn't really make a call on it. You know, it's up to you. And he said, look, we'll give him one chance. Which would have been untypical, generally speaking. You know, once you're in court, you're in the paper. So I think it was testament to his powers of persuasion, and kind of definitely worked on me. And I suppose I went up and advocated for him to a certain extent. I went back down and told him, the editor said he'd be given one chance, but that if he was up in court again, that was it. He was going to be in the paper. Quite soon after that, either later that year or the following year, sure enough, he was up in court again. This time, I think it was on the time when he robbed his friend's BankLink card when his friend was out cold or drunk or not knowing. And then the guy thought that he must have spent all this money because he'd been having a good night out. So anyway, that actually did appear in the papers. And I just, there was something about him. I just thought, this guy is actually very interesting here, you know. So I kind of kept an eye on his career, if you could call it that, over the years. And I was just fascinated by some of his maneuvers. Like, he had this incredible ability to convince people who were left absolutely shocked that they'd been talking to a con man. Like, they just couldn't believe it. He was so persuasive.
Gambling was beginning to take over my life more. I was only 20, 21. I couldn't see a way out of it. It was beginning to consume my thoughts more. I was going to bookies earlier in the day. I was reading more racing-based newspapers. I was spending a lot more time in betting offices. Even when I didn't have money or pulling strokes, I would go into a betting office socially just to chat to lads in the betting shop. I didn't see that as a problem. I saw it as a choice, but it wasn't a choice. It was a serious problem. I decided that I wasn't going to take money from anybody that I knew anymore. those two things that we discussed earlier, and I'm not trying to disguise the fact that I've committed crimes, I have, but I was genuinely disgusted by my actions towards those people because I know them. They're good people. I shouldn't be doing this kind of shit. So I decided I'll move tack. I'll take, you know, my next one would be from a business or from a bank or somebody that's insured. And that's the way I went. But I came up with an idea that I'd go and I'd tell a bank manager that I'm after selling a house. And then I'm just going to be waiting for a couple of weeks for the money to come back from the sale of the house, open up an account, call back in the next day, and give him a sob story about needing something and get him to give me an overdraft, which I'd clean out and go, and that'd be the end of it and never repay it. And I'd gotten away with that a couple of times in different banks. And I'm not talking about huge amounts of money. I'm talking about a couple of hundred quid here and a couple of hundred quid there. But I remember one morning, I was going to go down to a bank in Tipperary town, which is about 25 miles from here, and pull one of these little scams. So I rang the bank the previous day and the man says, oh yeah, come down. So I got up the next morning. I didn't have a car at the time and there was no bus, so I said I'd hitch. So I'm hitching, and then I was half an hour there and I remember, fuck, I had a probation appointment this morning, forgot about it. I'd come up with some bullshit. Got back, rang the probation officer, really sorry about this morning, mother was sick, take her to the doctors or whatever, stuck there all day with her. So that wasn't you. I saw hitching on the Tipperary road at 10 o'clock this morning. Straight away, got caught with this scam as well. The guards at Tipperary found out about it fairly quickly. So that was kind of a way that the escalation was going. And like, the initial check was a £30 thing. The thing with my mate, the one with the ATM, was I think about 100. Then the first scam with the overdraft at the banks were for 250. So the amounts are beginning to go up all the time. As I become more reckless, the amounts that I'm conning and things like that are growing as well. Before, there were opportunistic things that I just felt, fuck it, I'll do it. See something, I'll grab it. This was where I had started to actually methodically come up with ideas. I got offered a job by a charitable organisation in Dublin that were basically just like, it was a legal charity. You know, they appointed fundraisers, so they just gave me a job as a fundraiser. So I was just going around to businesses, fully legitimately representing the company, explaining to them what they did, blah, 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 and just getting checks and payouts. But I got to the point where they weren't all giving me checks. There was a lot of them giving me cash. So, you know, I was just not submitting the receipt books, pocketing half it, gambling most of it. And again, like everything else, didn't do it in a way where I knew I wasn't going to get caught. Got caught. I think the full total on that one was £625 or something. I suppose I'd been through the whole court thing a couple of times and not got sentenced. I had a kind of a good relationship even with the guards that were coming knocking on the door. When they were bringing me to court, they were speaking up for me. I was able to manipulate my parents, knowing that even if I do get caught, they're going to bail me out here. And just keep building all those things up. You just keep end up putting a wall in front of yourself and you think, sure, what's the worst thing that can happen? You know, if I get caught, I'll go to court. They'll repay the money for me. There's no judge going to lock me up because I have the money repaid. It's only a little bit of fraud. All these little justifications.
Do you think it would just go on like that?
No, I genuinely thought I'd always be able to stop. Thought I'd be able to adjust. I thought I'd be able to give it up. I thought I'd be able to get some form of normality in my life. I figured, you just need a proper job. You just need to do this, or you just need to do it. No matter what I thought, didn't matter, like, because even if I did get the proper job or have the proper structure, I was still going to be gambling. And once I'm gambling, I'm a completely different person, you know.
I first sought treatment in October 1991. And the only reason I did it was to keep out of jail on what we had spoken about previously. Because I got a sentence in the district court and I was out on bail pending an appeal. I knew that if I went back to court with a glowing letter from a treatment centre, I had been told by my solicitor that there was a very good chance that I'd get a suspended sentence. I had no interest in going to treatment. I was their first gambler and I was the youngest person ever to go into a treatment centre at that time. So for me, it was a very strange experience. It was almost surreal. When I walked in there, there was nobody else there, only alcoholics. again, me being me, I felt out of place. Kind of goes back to the whole feeling out of place when you're a child, you know, seems to be a pattern with me. You know, I couldn't identify with a lot of what was going on there because they were all just drink stories, hangovers, drink, drink, drink. I didn't have an issue with drink, thankfully. Oh, it was fucking mind-numbing at the start. Like I said, I just found it hard to switch on to the whole thing because I was going for walks with one poor man. I'll never forget him. He would have been in his 50s, I'd say, at the time. I was 22. And he was so badly fucked up from drink. He'd had several strokes. He couldn't talk properly. He was hyperactive. And he actually frightened me, that guy. And I'm just walking with these guys and thinking, what the fuck am I doing here? Like I said, I genuinely felt I had nothing in common with these people at all. I had a bit of an incident one night in the TV room. I always remember the Rugby World Cup was on, 1991. Because we were in treatment, we wouldn't get to see matches or whatever the case may be, but there was always a highlights programme on at 8 o'clock. So I made a beeline for the TV, as I do, and I got into the room and there was a Scottish woman there, Noreen, and we clashed constantly from day one. And I got in, really looking forward to watching the highlights of the rugby, and she's sitting in there watching Coronation Street. She knew how much we wanted to watch the rugby. Thought she was being a little bit shitty about the Coronation Street thing, blah, blah, blah. Arguments ensued. And I took the moral high ground with her, of course, because I always felt that I was, you know, well able to hold my own in an argument, shall we say. And there was a lot of words said, some of them bad. And I can't quite remember what I said to her, but I said something that was particularly close to the bone. And she turned around and let the remote control fly at me. And I ducked. There was a poor fucker behind me, got it straight on the bridge of the nose, broke his glasses. And the remote control shattered. So that kind of put a damper on the whole night. The lady that founded that treatment centre, Sister Mairead, Kelly is her name. She's some woman. Mairead called two of us into her office and it was quite literally like being a five-year-old at school, the way she talked to both of us. Bold boy, bold girl kind of thing. You know, there was a lot of kind of harsh words said. She told us that we were, you know, we were adults. We shouldn't be behaving like kids. Then we got the whole thing about damage and property, which we did. We had to pay for that. We had to buy new remote controls. Myself and Noreen went for a walk afterwards and we had a good chat about things. And I found out a lot about her. I told her a lot about me. A half an hour later, we went from being sworn enemies to the best of friends, you know. These are people that you're with for the next 28 days, no matter what. You know, you're going to be living, breathing the same air as them, waking up next to them in a room. They're your life for the next 28 days. You get to know so much about those people when you're there because Wednesdays are family days. And the family days were particularly horrible because the counsellors would meet your family privately. Families would have their own group session in the morning. And we used to be convinced that, right, they're in there now plotting together, writing their notebooks about what they're going to have a go at us in the afternoon about. And we all got it. Every one of us at some stage got it. Like, I remember my mother and my sister. My sister was only a kid at the time. My mother just went for me. Like, not physically, but she had 22 years of built up things to say to me that she never, ever, ever said to me because I was always the golden boy at the, you know. And she was encouraged by the counsellors to get it off her chest and by Jesus, did she do it. I went in fully thinking that she's going to sit down and she's going to say, Jesus, isn't he great? He's here now. He's trying to do something about it. Good on him. Hope it goes well for him. Blah, 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 blah. What the fuck? She did everything bar come over and batter me with her handbag. I didn't know where this was coming from. Like, I just did not know where it was coming from or what I was going to do about it. And I was disgusted with myself having to listen to it afterward. You know, like I said, if any of my friends came to me and gave out to me or whatever, I'd take it on the chin. But when your mother says something like that to you, it's sincere. And the worst thing about it was that you could tell that no matter how crass she was or whatever she was saying, it was coming from a place of love. It wasn't coming from badness or her having a go. She was basically articulating what I had been doing to her for the previous 15 years. You know, that's not good. Yeah, I couldn't even look at her. Like, I mean, she was sitting across from me. It was a kind of a circular situation, and residents would have been on one side and families on the other. And like, I could see some residents, they're just shaking their head at me when she was saying what she was saying, as if to say, Jesus, you bastard, you know. And then some of the other family members that were there giving me the eyes as well, they would have brought up things in the family group that I would have made up at treatment. And she's just going, what the fuck, you know, he didn't do that, or he didn't say, you know, things like that. Literally caught again telling lies. That was the first time that I ever got a kind of a good look at myself, and I didn't like what I saw. Like, it was not nice, you know.
What did you see?
A weak person. Somebody who couldn't say no, and somebody who was manipulative, you know, that would do not horrible things really, but just do bad things to get his own way and do stupid things. Because, like, you know, we keep going back. Like, there's none of my crimes have been big masterstroke or vindictive. You know, they've all been relatively small, stupid things that I always knew I was going to get caught for. You kind of reflect on that as well when you're in there, and you just go, what the fuck is all this worth it? Like, after a while, you learn a lot by listening. You learn an awful lot by just keeping your mouth shut, sitting down and listening to stuff. I was too young. I still had too many scams left in me. I had too much gambling left to do. You know, I just didn't have it all done at the time. I wasn't burnt out from it. And I went in there for the wrong reasons. You know, if I went in there for the right reasons, maybe it would have been different. But I still don't believe it would have, because of my age. Guy, I was sitting there with a guy one day, and I listened to this guy's wife on a Wednesday tell us how he used to come through the door 10 o'clock at night and beat the shit out of her and leave the kids to go hungry and this, that and the other thing. And I'm just sitting there looking at him, you prick, you know. And that then made me feel, Jesus, I'm not that bad, you know. So basically what you do is you justify to yourself that your actions aren't half as bad as they really are, because you're not as bad in your eyes as the guy sitting next to you. What that guy did or didn't do is nothing to do with me. I can see that today. In treatment, big saying is, you're never going to get a recovery until you hit your rock bottom. I certainly hadn't hit mine at that stage. Now, I did tell him that I did, and I cried, and I, you know, I laid it on, and poor me, and I got A grades to everything I did in treatment and all that. But it was, looking back at it now, 70% bullshit. I told the counsellors what they wanted to hear, told myself what I wanted to hear, started believing myself, and it was just all another scam, I suppose, for want of a better way of looking at it. It was a scam for me to fool a judge to keep me out of jail, and it worked.
One of the things I found really difficult about this whole process has been trying to strike a balance between having sympathy for Pat's issues while at the same time challenging his stories. And this is particularly true around his visits to rehab, because obviously recovery from addiction is a very serious, very difficult, and often very fragile thing. You want to respect that and to respect the work that people do there. And that includes Pat, no more or less than anyone else. So I feel a little uncertain when I'm questioning anything that he says about this. I've never been through it. Like, I don't know what it's like. What right have I to be second-guessing him?
But then he's sitting there telling you that 70% of what he did and said in rehab was bullshit. That it was, in his own words, just all another scam. So what do you do with that?
What do you do with it knowing that he would return to rehab later on?
When you know that 30-odd years after all this, he's going to come out of prison telling the world that he's changed.
I guess the question I end up asking myself is this. What does recovery look like? How do you know that someone has put their past behind them, that they've got things under control? Is the recovery real, or is it just a front? And I guess that's something that everyone with any experience of addiction is asking themselves all the time.
They're looking at their friends, their family members, or even themselves and asking, how can I know for sure? And maybe, you know, you can't ever really know.
I'd imagine that's what Pat's parents were asking themselves when he finally got home from rehab.
There was no yellow ribbons or party balloons waiting for me at the door when I got home. I didn't even have to price the bus home. And that all helped me like that, make my mind up with regard to what I need to do next.
That night, lying there in his childhood bedroom, he decided things would have to change, and change quick. The very next morning, he spotted a classified ad in the newspaper, a publishing company in Dublin looking for someone to sell ads in their publications.
I said, fuck it, I'll give it a go, see how it goes. And I did. Went up, got the job on a trial basis for a couple of days to see how it goes. And I ended up spending the next 20, 21 years up there. So there was no looking back.
The Gambler is produced and presented by Nicola Tallant and me, Ian Molini. The executive producer for Go Loud is Owen Brennan, and Darren Cleary is the commissioning editor for Go Loud. Sound design is by Neil Kavanagh. The Go Loud promotion, design and video team for The Gambler is Roisin Riley, Siobhan Walsh, Cameron Rooney, Andrew McConnell and Dara Murphy. Legal support was from Mars Solicitors. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in this series, you can contact Gambling Care on 1800 936 725 or visit gamblingcare.ie.